Those of you who know me know I'm usually kind of chipper when I give these talks, but if I'm extra chipper this morning, you know.
I'm in Canada because only in Canada and England can I get my favorite breakfast cereal, Shreddies. So I had my bowl this morning. I feel good. So anyway, calm me down at some point. Anyway, so what I'm going to talk about today really is, the central problem in theoretical condensed matter physics, which is how do you study systems with many degrees of freedom? This is going back to Boltzmann and Gibbs and many greats through the years. And so I'm going to tell you about some systems with some very special properties. But so to answer this question, well, there's many ways to answer it. And one of them is to go to some genius like Boltzmann or Gibbs, or in this case, Ansager, and you let them tell you the answer. So this is the entire text of a paper that Ansager wrote. It's a question session in Rushbrook's talk at the same conference. The conference was in Italy. It's in Nuovo Cimento. And the language is, if you sort of stare at it for a little bit, you can see what he means by it. In modern language, what he did was write down the magnetization in the two-dimensional Ising model. And there's these stories he just stood up and did this, but he did this at several conferences. So very clearly he had this result and wanted to share, but hadn't written the paper or hadn't finished the paper yet. There actually is a draft of a paper out there, which I have. So so you just let these guys stand up and tell you these dramatic things that the magnetization in the Ising model is 1 minus k squared to the 1/8. And so when you don't have geniuses to tell you what the answer is, you have to maybe work a little harder. And another genius told us what we could do in a lot of situations, which is what condensed matter people often call Landau theory, Landau-Ginzburg theory. Maybe a more modern and slightly more general way of calling it is effective field theory. You deal with effective degrees of freedom. This is almost always useful, even when it gives the wrong answer, because if it's giving the wrong answer, you have to understand why the sort of simple effective theory isn't giving the right answer. But and even quantitatively, sometimes you can compute a lot of great stuff. But as probably everybody here knows, near critical points in lower dimensions, including 3, it usually fails miserably quantitatively. And so, for example, let's go to the 2D Ising model, the one that Ansager wrote down that beautiful formula for. And because I'm on a quantum day, and it's easier anyway, I'm going to just write everything in quantum language. So instead of doing the two-dimensional classical Ising model, I'm going to do the 1D quantum Ising chain. The physics is completely equivalent. And then the Hamiltonian of the system is very simple. So you've just got 2 state spin systems. You've got a whole chain of them. We'll end up doing periodic boundary conditions here. It doesn't matter. And so there's just nearest neighbor interactions, and then there's a flip term, the Hamiltonian. K is just a coefficient. So it's basically the simplest interacting Hamiltonian you can write down for a one-dimensional quantum system, I think. I can't think of anything simpler. And it's pretty obvious if that coefficient K, the one that flips, is small, then the term that favors lining up spins will win, and so you'll have order. The spins will all want to line up. In Landau theory, it's easy to apply. It tells you that there indeed is this order parameter, the expectation value of the whether the spin is up or down, and it'll vanish as the square root of the distance you are from the critical point. So the critical point is k equals 1. That's not totally obvious, but that's well understood why that happens. But so the formula that Ansager tossed in the conference talk, and actually was co-derived with Kaufman, as you notice from those words there, is extremely different from this. Yang is the one who eventually wrote up the proof, which is probably why Ansager and Ben never bothered to finish his and Kaufman's paper. But the fact is no, that's the exponent is 1/8, and so this is so long before people really understood the Ginzburg criteria and all this, there was already a stunning counterexample to Landau theory. So I'm going to focus on formulas like this for the rest of the talk, but the thing I want to draw your attention to now is, so this Landau theory just tells you it's proportional to this, and fine, you can say, wow, the exponent's 1/8 instead of 1/2. We just have to understand this. But this is an equality. This is an exact formula, and for any value of k. This is not a proportional to. This is not a only for k close to 1, the critical point. This is an absolutely exact result for any k. And that may be a fact that's not appreciated in the world, but maybe at the end of the day I'll get you to appreciate that fact. So it's amazing. Okay, so... Well, so this is the slide that just says what I just said. We know a lot of things about how to compute critical exponents now, the beauty of the renormalization group, lots and lots of stuff. But why is that formula I just wrote down so simple but still exact in an interacting system? So anyway, that's the topic of the talk. And I'm going to come up with other examples where have similar behavior. So first I'm going to try and explain why is this special. In other words, why does such a formula even exist, much less... Ansager and Kaufman found it more than 60 years ago. And I'm going to give an example that where a similar formula, it's a special case of the XYZ chain that most of you probably know. And I'll show you some similar formulas, and I'll sort of mumble that this has something to do with supersymmetry and talk about some other models. And then at the end, it's going to be a great last 5 minutes because I'm going to flash all these unbelievable results once you start doing this stuff. So... You'll see.
That's why I keep you awake. Okay, so let's
answer this first question I put. So what's so special about the Ising chain? And everyone here is, it's free fermions. You can compute everything. And that's the worst insult ever, the Ising model, because all you can get out of free fermions easily is the free energy. Now, the free energy is an important thing. But if you want that magnetization, or you want a two-point function or anything involving the spins, remember, that's what the way we understand the Ising model, it's not so easy to get in terms of free fermions because the map from the spins to fermions is non-local. People usually call it a Jordan-Wigner transformation, although in this context it was Kaufman who invented it. That was her utterly brilliant insight to simplify Ansager's solution. And so that computation of magnetization is still hard. I mean, it's Topliss matrices, Zagos theorem, you may have heard of this stuff. I mean, it's now people know how to do it, but it's not an easy computation. And to give you an example, and mostly to put in a plug for a completely unknown but beautiful paper by Baeser and Earhart, if you do the computation for the classical dimer model deforming from the square lattice to the triangular lattice and look for the monomer one-point function, basically, it's in the same universality class. It's got the same 1/8. But of course, it's a different physical system, so the formula doesn't have to be exact. Nevertheless, there's a beautiful and simple exact formula. We couldn't derive the formula. They were the ones who did that. And so it's hard. So I want to rephrase the question. All right, so maybe it's free fermions. And so are there any non-free fermion models where you can write down these simple but exact formulas that you can... The formulas are much simpler than the computation. And so the answer to this, of course, is yes. And there's a known example going back about 25 years. It's called the Cairo-Potts model. I won't write it down. If those of you know what the Potts model is, it's a version that breaks the SN symmetry to ZN symmetry and also breaks parity. And it certainly isn't a free fermion model. It has something to do with parafermions. But as Eduardo knows, parafermions are definitely not free fermions. But yet... there was a formula for the order parameter. So this is just basically like the magnetization, just you have the degree of freedom that runs from 1 to n now. And so you have you can make multiple order parameters to understand how the Zn symmetry gets spontaneously broken in the low temperature phase. And there's, again, a stunningly simple formula. Again, this is an exact formula. K appears in the same way. It's just a coefficient of one of the two kinds of terms in the Hamiltonian. And that's it. This is this formula. So this formula... was conjectured just based on looking at series expansions by Albertini, McCoy, and others. And it took 15 years for Baxter to prove it. If it takes 15 years for Baxter to prove something, then you know it's not an easy thing to do. R is just the thing in there.
Oh,
so just to make different order parameters. Yes, I said R equals 1 for the simplest. So you should get 1/8 if I just said R equals 1. The Z2 case is just the Ising model. So I, that, if I wrote the formula down right, that should just be the same on Ansager 1 minus k squared to 1/8.
for n equals 2.
Okay, so now I can rephrase the question of what's so special. Is there an extension of the Ising model, and what's so special about the Ising model? So now we want to ask, what's so special about the Karl Potts models? These models are fascinating, which is why Baxter spent 15 years trying to prove this thing. I'll just give you two quick hits of what's great about the Karl Potts models. Well, the Hamiltonian itself, so if you just split the Hamiltonian into these two terms, H, so in the Ising model, H naught would be the sigma z term, and H1 would be the sigma x, the spin flip term. And they're just analogous two terms in the Karl Potts model. And if you just work out the commutators, you find this, you do three commutators, three commutators, you get the same as one. And that's just amazing. So it's not true, for example, for the ordinary Potts model, but it's true for the Karl Potts model. And the amazing historical fact is this is actually how Onsager solved the Ising model originally before Kaufman came up with her mapping to free fermions, was to exploit this. From this, you can see there's conserved quantities, and then he worked it out for small system sizes, saw the pattern, and then wrote down the free energy in typical genius fashion.
I mean, do we have a model with two commutators which have these?
Yeah, I mean, the people who study this have messed around a lot. I mean, so the model I'm going to show you, actually, I don't know what the analog is, and, you know, I've spent a little time. Maybe someone, I said before, you know, this is one of these things. Maybe someone can, by the end of the talk, write down what the analog of this for the model I'm going to describe. I don't know. Why not? The thing is, this, you form a whole algebra, and Dolan and Grady were kind of the first ones to point out you can make a whole algebra out of this, and then it leads to these infinite number of conserved quantities. No. Probably no. That can't quite work unless you put an I in, right? Because it won't be Hermitian, right? You have to have the same part, right? Three has to be one, because otherwise you just take. I mean, you can put I's in or something, but somehow that one doesn't seem right. And this is just the sort of the generating function of the algebra. And so another one that the people who study integral billiards, a lot of people who've studied this model for a long time. Focus on these algebraic stuff because they, like me, like algebras. But one thing, if you're a field theory type that's not appreciated, I should have put John Carty was the one who pointed this out, is that if you write this down in a field theory language, the coupling of the chiral symmetry breaking term, or I should say parity symmetry breaking term, it's chiral in the 2D sense, the parity symmetry breaking term doesn't renormalize. And for those of us who do field theory, that's a really big signal that something is going on. So now we want to look for other models that have this behavior. So there's some string theory types. So this will be boring to them. The rest of you probably might not know about this. But supersymmetric field theories have all these amazing non-renormalization theorems. Emphasize that's not non-renormalizability, which is the exact opposite thing. Non-renormalization means that you just sort of write down bare quantities in your Hamiltonian, and then the physical quantities you measure are related in some transparent way. No infinite renormalization, no rescaling, none of the usual things we have to deal with when we deal with field theory. So to give an example, in some one-dimensional supersymmetric field theories, usually in that world they're called Landau-Ginzburg theories, you can just compute the mass of the part, the kinks in the theory, the gap of the kinks in the theory with a completely pedestrian computation, a one-line computation. You just look at the minimum of the superpotential and you essentially write down the answer. So these things are well known in the particle and string theory world. If you've heard of the Seiberg-Witten work on gauge theories in four dimensions, it very much follows from this behavior, the fact that certain quantities don't renormalize. So what this hints then, at least to me, because I like supersymmetry, is that we should look for stat-mech models now that have some supersymmetry. At least in their continuum limit, they would turn into a supersymmetric field theory. That seems like a good starting point. Now, there's some way, and I'll get to this at the end, there's ways to build in explicit supersymmetry, even in the lattice model. I'm going to talk about that, but for now, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm just going to talk about some lattice models who turn that when you take the scaling limit, write them down as a field theory, they turn into a supersymmetric field theory. So this is one that probably every single person in this room has heard of. It's called the XYZ spin chain. So the Heisenberg model, of many fame, which just would be Jx equals Jy equals Jz. So instead, now we have a two-parameter family of couplings. We just allow those terms to vary. And so what I'm telling you, I'm not going to prove it, but it's not hard to see, is that if you set, so there's this is two-parameter couplings. You can always rescale one coupling out by putting it in front. So there's two couplings here, and if you put one condition on the two couplings, that particular model, when you look at its scaling limit, turns into a supersymmetric field theory. And for a quick thing for people to know something about this, there's a critical point where Jx equals Jy. That's where this is called usually the XXZ model. And at the critical point, you can see it's a free boson. It's known that a free boson has a point where there's a supersymmetry. You can create the supercharges out of exponentials of the boson. And then you perturb away from this point, and there's known to be supersymmetry preserving deformation. So that was just designed to show that there's more to that. If people want to ask me to say that in more detail, I'd be happy to. But otherwise, just trust me. And the other reason, actually, if you didn't know a single thing about supersymmetry, you could look at this series of papers by a bunch of smart people in the stat-mech world and say this model with this, so the XYZ model with that particular condition, Jx, Jy plus those others equals zero, is really special. And it goes way back even to the 70s, shortly after Baxter solved the XYZ chain integral. So it's an integrable model. Baxter computed a bunch of stuff, and he found something very peculiar. His equations for the ground state energy of this unbelievably simplified at that special line. Now, when I say unbelievably simplified, you say, well, 3 times s squared plus 3, that doesn't look too simple. But the usual answers are parameterized in terms of elliptic theta functions. And it's not even like you just get a formula that's an elliptic theta function. You have to solve some equation involving elliptic theta functions, plug it into some other elliptic theta functions, and that gives you this answer. So this is remarkably simple for a ground state energy. And what then Stroganov, looking again on the computer, I think, notice something peculiar that Baxter didn't notice. If you just do this for finite systems and just shift the Hamiltonian by this ground state energy, this isn't just some continuum statement. That was what Baxter observed. As L gets large, the formula simplifies. He actually observed this is exactly true. In other words, the ground state energy in a finite system is exactly zero for any size system. And that's even simpler than the Ising model. I mean, the Ising model, we can compute the ground state energy exactly, but you have to fill this Fermi C and all that, and the formula isn't so nice. But this one, there's the formula right there. Okay, so this is the model. Obviously, this is God telling us something special about this model. So this is the model I'm going to study for the majority of the talk. It's the XYZ chain with that special condition, and I just parameterize that condition by a parameter s. You can check that those three things satisfy there. It's sort of nice in this parameterization because there's a symmetry that exchanges Jx, Jy, Jz. Obviously, that's a symmetry. And in this parameterization, it just corresponds to s, or fractional linear transformation on s. All right, so let's do the physics. So Hamiltonian per second. So if we look now at s goes to 0, what happens? These two terms vanish. This one has some non-zero positive coefficient. And so what happens is now all the spins want to align. Okay, so at s goes to 0, if you look at this magnetization, well, you get 1 m of 1. So s equals 1 is, oh, that's 0. Sorry. Ooh, bad. It's the first time I get this talk. That's a 0, not a 1. M of 0 is 1. I cover this up. So this is the limit where it's completely polarized everything. Okay, so now here's the miracle. So now, you know, not thinking of anything else to do, now we have nice computers. Supersymmetric systems, ones with these properties, have other stuff that make computing easier, but to get the numbers I showed you, I didn't do anything easier. I diagonalized the Hamiltonian on MAPLE. And this is not a numerical diagonalization. This is a parameter. So I kept the parameter S in there. So you just tell it to diagonalize a big matrix with S's and use translation invariants and something to make it doable. And then I expand the answer to some ratio of polynomials and S, and then I just tell it, well, expand the answer around this completely ordered limit where all the spins are lined up. And so this is what you get just for 5 through 11 sites. I didn't say it, it was on the slide, but I didn't say it. This property of Stroganov's, this conjecture, actually is only true when the number of sites is odd. I should have emphasized that. Yeah, this is not believed to matter for the continuum properties, but this property that the ground state energy is exactly zero is true only for, apparently true only for number of sites being odd. And if you want a reason why odd versus even is different, is because where there's two states with all the spins lined up, so all up and all down, if the number of spins is odd, those two don't mix because there's a mod 2 symmetry of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian, you can rewrite it so it only flips two terms at a time. And so they, so those don't mix when it's odd. They do mix when it's even.
Basically break supersymmetry on the lattice?
Well, I don't know what the supersymmetry is explicitly in this case. And there's a model that I'll get to, I hope, at the end, where is basically the same physics. And no, the Witten index is not vanishing. So this. And in fact, the two ground states here are more or less the two ground states of the supersymmetric model. Okay, so here's the miracle. Well, you look at these formulas. And so there's a bunch of numbers. But the thing you're supposed to notice now is, okay, I just do 5 sites. It's whatever it is. But now notice, you just look down. Those are all the same. Those are all the same. Okay, now that only those 3 are the same. Now only those 2 are the same. And I have up to 17. You can see the pattern persists. This is a complete, utter miracle. Right. I mean, I'm just solving some ugly Hamiltonian in fine size. It's got a 0 eigenvalue, but that's special. But that's not special enough to do this. The terms in the expansion of the magnetization don't depend on the size of the system once the system gets sort of big enough. So in other words, the terms up to order L are independent of L. And that's completely unheard. Pick any system you want, even the Ising model, and put it on the computer. You don't see anything like this. So it's natural to say, well, this quantity is very special. So those quantities are exact when L goes to infinity. So this is why the title of the talk is said, from few to many, you just solve the system. It's a special system for a few sites, as much as your crappy 4-year-old laptop can handle. Every single thing was done on this 4-year-old laptop. And you have an exact result for the magnetization, at least as a series. And, well, so this is starting to answer, it's not answering why these things are so special, but it's finding something special about this model. So we want to sum the series now, of course. This is exact when we sum the series. And so there's this fantastic resource called the Online Encyclopedia of Integer Sequences. And if you plug in a sequence, then it'll tell you if this is some known sequence. So I did this for this. That's actually those coefficients divided by 4. You see all these divided by 4. So forget the first one, and then all the other ones divided by 4. And you get something that was somewhat disappointing. It's the number of terms in the expansion divided. There's actually a generating function for this, which looks like a partition function. So that's sort of interesting. But it's a little bit disappointing because I wanted a formula like Ansager's, not the divided difference in terms of the bivariate divided differences. So that was a little bit disappointing, but I said, aha, I'm a physicist. I don't need these combinatorialists. I think that's really interesting, actually, what he wrote there. So anyway, but now let's think about physics. So let's think about what should happen at the critical point, which in my conventions is S equals 1, where it becomes the XXZ model. Well, you know the dimensions of the operators. Baxter computed these decades ago. The dimension of the perturbing operator is 4/3. The magnetization at this point is dimension 1/3. You can even check with the numerics that the 1/3 is right. And so what standard scaling arguments tells you, the magnetization should vanish instead of being the 1/8 that happens for Ansager. This tells you this should be dimension. It should be go to 0 with a square root singularity instead of a 1/8 singularity. So, okay, so now think, well, all right, so it should vanish at S equals 1. That's very far from where the series is good, but it says it should vanish there with the square root of singularity. That's something we know that just if you're generating the series via some combinatorial argument, you don't know, but we know from the physics. So he says, well, at least I'll square the series, right? That's my brilliant innovation here. And so you square that stupid series, and that's what you get. I sent email to the guy who put that sequence on the web. He was surprised, let's say. Anyway, so that series I can resum without the aid of the online Encyclopedia of Integer Sequences, and that's what it is. And then you just take the square root of it, which we know how to do, and there you go. So that's the formula for the magnetization in the this XYZ chain that has this special property. So we'd improve. I mean, this is improved. And so, I mean, I sent it to him, and he said, wow. And, you know, you check, you know, as many terms in the series you can generate there. It's true. But it hasn't yet been proved that that sequence is the same as the square root of this sequence.
That's good.
Because it's only the coefficients up to order L. Coefficients up to order L are independent of L. Okay. I mean, so obviously, right. In the finite size systems, you're not all going to be the same.
Right. That's,
that's great. You solve for as many as you can, okay. And then you see, can I now resum the series?
That's exactly right.
So this is an exponent that Baxter found?
Yeah, the exponent, I don't know if you, Baxter. It comes from just taking the 8 vertex, going to 6 vertex to 8 vertex model. So, yeah, the exponent's Baxter found. I mean, I forget if he got that. He must have that. It's easy. You can do it from the Ashton Tower model. So anyway, just those are plots, and there you can see the finite size curves versus this, conjecture, because we haven't proved, but we've just observed that it fits the series, and you can see these things. I mean, you'll never see from the finite size data this singularity, but you can see it's heading down to the singularity. Okay, so good. I have about 15 minutes, so I will now start to speed up, if that wasn't fast enough. Anyway, so this is not a fluke of the magnetization. If you look at the sort of nearest neighbor two-point point, this isn't scaling, this is just sigma. Oh, that's supposed to be a Z up there, I'm sorry. Those are Zs. And anyway, so there's formulas, and this is non-vanishing in both regions, the high and the low temperature region, and you get different forms. What strikes me as sort of strange about this, so these are exact formulas, but the critical point is S equals 1. Neither of these are singular at S equals 1. So these formulas don't show any evidence, really, of the phase transition. The only evidence is this one is good up to S equals 1, and this is good for S greater than 1. And the only, and in fact, if you compare the two, they're exact, and I think they don't differ till their third derivatives, if I remember right. There. So it's it's funny. Just because there's a singularity in the model doesn't mean any quantity you write down is singular. This presumably in the other regime is the continuation onto some excited state. That kind of stuff happens. So cooler, so it doesn't have to just be a ground state property. If you define the one kink energy, let me just say quickly what that is. Since we've got two ground states very heuristically in a gap theory, you would think the excitations would correspond to kinks between a region where you're in one ground state and then a region where you're in another. That's a standard thing, and actually you can compute the S matrix and so forth, and all that's right. And so actually to compute this now, we don't go to an even number, odd number of sites. We go to an even number of sites, because then if we twist the boundary conditions, we can force there to be a one kink state. If we kept the odd boundary conditions, periodic boundary conditions for an odd number of sites, then you have to have two kinks. So that's harder to extract what the kink energy is. You have to pick a boundary condition that just forces a single kink, and this was the easiest way I could think of. And so you do the same thing, and even though there it's not a zero energy ground state like the ones I gave you before, but you can still crunch. I can only get up to L equals 10 on this thing. But there you do, you get the series, and I was, again, just... or at least stunned. The gap is just something vanishes. This is now as S goes to infinity, which is another critical point, but related by duality to the original one. And it just vanishes as power of 3/2. That, again, follows from scaling and ancient arguments. But this formula is not an asymptotic formula. This is for near the critical point. This is exact for any values, again, with this usual caveat that you throw out order L terms. And there's the plot. I mean, it's almost indistinguishable. The red one is the exact formula, and then the other ones are the ones I got just getting up to 12. I just did that an hour ago. I could maybe do 14 if I had another few minutes. All right, so let's try now. So for the rest of the talk, I want to tell you a little bit more about supersymmetry and why all this stuff, although certainly a miracle, is a miracle that has its origins in symmetry, as pretty much, I think, do all miracles in physics have their origins in symmetry? Probably. Anyway, so I'm going to write down a different model. And this one has supersymmetry. Since I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to blitz through it, but the definition of the model. But let me just emphasize, we have a Hamiltonian. So what I mean by supersymmetry is this. There's some operator, Q, which squares to zero. And I'll write down an explicit example in a second. And then the Hamiltonian is the anti-commutator of Q with Q dagger. And so Q increases fermion number by one, Q dagger decreases it. That's why we call it a supersymmetry. And that Hamiltonian then commutes with Q. That's a trivial piece of algebra.
It's not supersymmetric.
It probably is. There's a paper we wrote where it shows that at the critical point, you can find a hidden supersymmetry. The supersymmetry is strange. It changes the number of sites by one. So it Q acting on a given state takes it to a state with a different number of sites. This almost certainly can be generalized, but we haven't done it yet.
So that model is motivated by supersymmetry, but the exact symmetry is not quite
clear. Well, it's field theory. The continuum limit is a supersymmetric field theory. And, in fact, to go to this slide here, it has this property that the ground state energy is exactly zero. And that's a characteristic when you write down a Hamiltonian that's like this. It's guaranteed that it's greater than or equal to zero. And if you can find something annihilated by the Q and the Q dagger, then it is zero. So that's a strong hint. That's why, even though we haven't shown it off the critical point,
so this condition on the coupling constant is derived from the zero energy ground state from this condition. You have this GXL1.
No, it was just. No, well, that's not, no, it's just, I mean, ultimately that will obviously be, once you prove there's a supersymmetry, you'll see you can only write the Hamiltonian in this form when that condition is satisfied. But this was all just Baxter's computation and the scaling limit, and then this numerical observation that in that case. Now, in this case, why this is different, now I'm creating a model where this is built in. You know, so instead of looking magically, I'm going to say, well, let's start with supersymmetry and see if we can do it. Okay, so to go quickly, so to write down, I need an operator that squares to zero. With fermions, you can do that. One example is if you just take some lattice and take fermion creation operators and sum them all up, create a fermion on each point, square it, it obviously squares to zero because they anti-commute, and if they're spinless fermions, you can't put two at one site. So that works, but it's trivial. The Hamiltonian isn't anything interesting. So what we do is the sort of next simplest thing is we make the Q, the supersymmetry operator, create a fermion at every point, but we exclude nearest neighbor fermions. So fermions are fat. So not only do they exclude each other on site, they exclude each other on the nearest neighbor sites, and that's Q. And then you work out the anti-commutator of Q and Q dagger, and that's the Hamiltonian. It has a hopping term. These things are just there to preserve this restriction that fermions can't be next to each other, and there's this funny potential. And this is supersymmetric when precisely the parameters are tuned like this. For this model, using the supersymmetry, you can prove that there's actually only two ground states. You might expect with this sort of model, again, since I'm running out of time, I can't belabor this, but if you look at it, you might expect that there would be three nail states where you have a particle on every third site, because there's a next nearest neighbor repulsive potential, so they want to be three apart. And that's more or less right, except you end up with only two ground states, and that's one of the powers of supersymmetry that you can do it. So we look at the model now where we sort of focus on this mod 3 property, and we stagger the couplings basically on every third site. And so you just end up with this Hamiltonian. It's a hopping term, and the coefficients here depend on whether you're hopping on or off of the third site or not, and the potential then again depends on whether you're on every third site. So you can either tune this parameter Z, I called, so that you want them on every third site like this, or you can tune the parameter Z so that you don't want them on every third site, and then study what's going on. And so, right, well, so now I made a big deal of miracles. Of course, this model wouldn't be telling you if this model didn't behave the same way. So the analog of the magnetization there, the analog of lining everything up, is up. Do you have a particle on every third site?
And so there turns out there's two ground states, which you group by parity, and there's formulas. Again, notice the square root of singularity. This model is in exactly the same universality class as this XYZ chain, which I should have said before, this is a Sein-Gordon model at a particular coupling, is the field theory. All right, so now it's getting boring. More series, more sums. Here, not to slam the online Encyclopedia of Integer Sequence, it's fantastic. I had no clue. It's not very obvious that that series is this, but those things are related to second Catalan numbers. Anyway, so that's how you do that. So that's really cool, but then you say, well, that's pretty ugly, and if I just define a new coupling, I get a much nicer formula, but of course, we wouldn't have been able to do that unless you saw how to resum the formula. All right, so now I promised a part where the results get ridiculous, so here's a ridiculous result part. So this is now two models in the same universality class that numerous quantities have that scale-free property. So that's pretty fantastic, but there's more. So I mentioned before the XYZ chain has this duality, just corresponds to interchanging sigma x with sigma z. In terms of this parametrization S, it just turns out to be that change in coupling. So you do that change in coupling, and you change X for Z or whatever. Well, in the supersymmetric model I wrote down, it's some hopping fermion model. There's no spin flip symmetry because of this exclusion, nearest neighbor exclusion rule. But nonetheless, when you just make this, you observe that, in fact, it has a duality. I don't know why, but I spent weeks of my life. I mean, it makes it look sort of obvious here, but this, it wasn't. It gets even more ridiculous. If you look at the ground states exactly, so that's how I compute these things, is you just solve this thing on the computer, look at the ground states. Ground states have all these magical properties. Because the ground state energy is exactly zero, you can see that these things have to turn into polynomials, and the polynomials have to truncate. And ask me more in the questions if you want to hear more about why that is. But that's just the answer for, was it seven sites? That's the ground state polynomial, just in some base translation invariant and parity invariant basis. Those things I wrote out are just the coefficients of each term. This term in particular is the coefficient of the term with all spins up, the sort of ordered state. And the other ones have various spins flipped. So that's for the XYZ model that I talked about. Now the supersymmetric, explicitly supersymmetric model I wrote down, I do the same thing. It's uglier because there's more terms. This was, I think, for, I forget now, 12 sites. 12 sites in this tray. Because the exclusion rule, it's, you can get the much bigger sites. And notice that polynomial. Now maybe that's just a fluke. 4 and 3 are not uncommon numbers in the world. But you do this up to, well, as much as we could do, which is 17 sites in the XYZ and 24 in the supersymmetric chain, and this relation is exactly true. So not only are the models in the same universality class, is that their ground state wave functions are related in some way. But wait, there's still more. Turns out these polynomials have been looked at before. There's this remarkable set of papers by Bajanov and Mangazeyev looking at the XYZ case, and they showed that those polynomials that I just wrote down, the 1 plus 3s squared plus 4s to the fourth, being an example, actually are related to the tau function of the Panleve-6 differential equation. And from this, you can get a recursion relation for those polynomials. So the ground state wave functions of both the XYZ chain and the supersymmetric model are basically determined by this bizarre but unbelievably interesting nonlinear differential equation. So why none of these things are proved. And now Bajanov and Mangazeyev have observed a lot, so it's essentially the same level of us. They observe remarkable properties, and then they showed an even more remarkable property. All right, so the reason for the last 5 minutes was hopefully to convince you that I think this is just the tip of the iceberg, pretty obviously. I'm pretty convinced that this will be able to be proved in less than 15 years. There's a lot of ways one can imagine proving these formulas I wrote down. So it could, like I said, there's a paper more or less done, so I better get it on the web before now I've given a talk. So maybe one of you will prove it in 15 minutes this afternoon. But just sum the Q series. There's a Q series for this. You just have to show Q series identity. This is the topological day, and I put a thing in my abstract, and I spent a lot of my time thinking about topological stuff. And this, believe it or not, does have something to do with it. There's this marvelous model due to Kataev for a topological phase. And it's a free fermion model, and that's why it has all the magic. Well, I'm pretty convinced that these sorts of models are absolutely positively the next thing after free fermion. So they're certainly a lot more special. I hope I've convinced you of that than free fermion, than a generic model, but they're obviously more complicated than a free fermion model. Somehow, they're a free fermion model hiding inside a very non-free fermion model. What those words mean, you'll tell me. But in any case, a more concrete question is, can you make a Kataev honeycomb model out of these? And you can. The question is, really, can you prove anything useful having made a Kataev honeycomb model out of these sorts of models? And I say, these models are simpler than icing. Icing doesn't have the zero energy thing. So maybe these are better than free fermions. As we saw was it the other day when people asking about numerics on free fermions. Free fermions are not always easy to deal with. And anyway, so maybe these are better. Is there a direct map? And I don't know what Padmore Base 6 means. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
So by this question about the Kataev honeycomb model, you mean a 2D generalization of...
Yeah, 2D. So Kataev honeycomb model, once you set it up right, is really just this unbelievably clever way of sort of turning a 1D free fermion model into a 2D one, but then still letting you, or I should say a 2D classical free fermion model into a 2D quantum one. And so then the question is, can we turn the 2D classical analogs of these models into, I can write down a model, but can I prove anything about it is what I want to do.